If psychology and pop culture had a baby, they'd call it the Shrink Tank Podcast. Our all-star panel of shrinks analyze and psychoanalyze what's happening in entertainment and pop culture. Hi, everybody. I'm Dave Verhagen, a psychologist, author, and general nuisance. And our regular panel's here with Rachel Kitson, a psychologist, and she's also a contributor to ShrinkTank.com. Rachel, anything you've been thinking about lately?
Well, I've been thinking about trying to do some sort of an advice column on the blog. And I don't know exactly how that would work, but I think it'd be kind of cool to have something where people could pose questions of some sort. And then, you know, myself or other kind of psychologists could respond to them. But I'm thinking that through. Need to meet with Mr. Verhagen and discuss that further.
Yes. I hear he's very difficult. And Frank Gaskell is a psychologist, more or less. He's the author of the popular Max Gamer graphic novel. He's also a contributor to a number of psychology and pop culture books edited by Travis Langley, like Star Wars and The Walking Dead Psychology and
Star Trek.
The Star Trek one that's coming out. And Frank is also usually pretty worked up about something. And Frank, anything you're worked up about today?
Actually, I'm in a really good mood today. I'm very even, calm, and mentally stable.
Have you been doing your mindfulness?
I have not.
Have you been taking your medicine?
I have.
Very good.
Thank you.
Good for you.
Thank you. Just a little tart of dyskinesia going on.
Which means
your tongue feels big today.
You're poking your tongue out a lot? Yep. Yeah, gotcha. And Jonathan Hederle, he's a counselor, a critic, and of course our sarcasm all-star. And each week he follows interesting stories of psychology in pop culture, and we call it Being Human.
This first article comes from sciencealert.com that talks about why groups of people can remember something that didn't happen. And so this came up, and it's been making headlines regarding Donald Trump's assertion that thousands of Muslims were cheering on the streets of New Jersey after 9/11. So it's this shared knowledge or transactive memory system has been researched about why people can recall something that didn't happen.
Yeah, and maybe this sort of relates back to what we were talking about last week with conspiracy theories and sort of this belief of kind of reorganizing your memory or re-remembering things or looking for information that sort of could be discrepant to what most people hold as true. But I think there are a lot of factors that play into this that they talk about in the article. You know, one is just if you have reinforcement from other people around you or who can kind of go along with it, that helps kind of seal that memory in. You know, whether you talk about it with other people, and the shock factor of what you're learning too, if it's something that's so sensational, it's going to be easier, kind of, there's going to be more emotional resonance tied to it. It's going to be more easily recollected. And sometimes we confuse things that are easily recalled with being true. And they also talk about eyewitness testimony of young kids where, you know, you're asked to recall things or you're kind of given leading questions, and that can kind of sometimes shape how we recollect things.
You know, I don't have the greatest memory in the world. I know this is a news flash to those around the table, but it's easy for me to understand forgetting something. It's harder to understand remembering something, especially a big event, not like, did I, you know, eat this or that or do something, but some big event to recall it in detail and it didn't happen.
And I don't believe Trump recalls that in detail.
I don't either.
Right.
I mean, I think he's preying on people who want to believe, and it's remembering or sharing false information to further an agenda, I think, in a lot of situations.
But what Jonathan's saying is that at least for some people that does happen, right, that some people can construct these memories. And I get that you could say to somebody, hey, remember when, and you kind of lead them and then they start to imagine it and then the imagination becomes like a memory. I kind of get that, but something like this where like I saw this on television right after, because especially around 9/11, it was so emotional and so intense that your memories are like burned into your head. I mean, I remember very vividly the images I saw on television, the coverage. I mean, I might not remember it word by word, but I do remember. And if you said, don't you remember when this thing happened? I think I would know or not know that.
And for that particular thing, I wonder, because I do remember, I don't remember what country it was.
I don't remember.
I want to say it was in the West Bank or somewhere, that there were crowds of people that were cheering that the World Trade Centers fell. I remember that vividly. But I'm wondering if some people saw that and are combining, hey, you know, that was in Jersey, and now they're combining those memories into something that did not exist.
I think that's probably what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something just with, not that all these things are related, but kind of suggestibility and the wiring of brains and how we kind of map things or categorize things based on sort of how they trigger us emotionally and what defense mechanisms are kind of there when we are processing that information or recalling it, all play into kind of these conspiracy theories and even kind of the suggestibility involved when you have like psychics, you know, who are kind of working and trying to get information or, you know, not that psychics aren't real and accurate.
We don't want to alienate our psychic viewers, population. Yeah.
They saw this coming. Right. So
exactly. That is good.
So yeah, I think there's just the human brain is kind of interesting in that way. And I think we can really trick ourselves into thinking whatever we want to sometimes.
So moving on, this next topic has been all over social media and the news, whether it be Huffington Post, UpRock, Psych Central. It's this question of, is affluenza real? And so once again, Ethan Couch, also known as the affluenza teen that was found not guilty of murder by claiming affluenza, a metaphorical illness whereby children or teens who grow up in a privileged lifestyle are largely isolated emotionally and developmentally from their working parents, and the result is greater depression, anxiety, or substance and alcohol abuse. But researchers don't generally refer to this as affluenza, but rather problems growing up in a culture of affluence. And so the question becomes, is affluenza a real thing?
I mean, I think it's a dumb question.
I'm sorry.
I think it's a let's make everything a disorder to remove responsibility from the actions of people. And it's increasing the disease model of people. And I just think it's stupid. You can read any novel throughout history that there's always been some kid like Couch, you know, the Great Gatsby, all these affluent children. What's the movie, not Dangerous Liaisons, but the one that was remade in the future with Sarah Michelle Gellar?
Yeah, I mean, Cruel Intentions.
Cruel Intentions. It's the same thing. There's no affluenza. I mean, yes, there are personalities that can be created from an environment like this, and yeah, they're narcissistic and they're stuck or whatever. But to be calling it something, I feel like removes responsibility, and I think this is exactly the situation in this case.
Well, first, I don't think he was found not guilty. I think this was just part of the defense of
right.
His case.
And he was given probation.
He was given probation.
Right. He was not sentenced to, but part of that had to do with his juvenile status and not with this affluenza idea. The other part, though, and this is what I don't know, and I've looked on a lot of stories about this. This came from the testimony of a psychologist mm-hmm. who made this statement. And what I wonder about is if he was using this word in a kind of a, not quite snarky, in a descriptive way, mm-hmm. but not to say, I think what's happened with the media coverage is this is like almost like it was suggested that this was a real disorder. I doubt that guy. Maybe, I don't know. This is why would in like, this isn't a disorder that would be found in any reasonable psychology book or textbook or even thought of that way. But what I wonder about is if it's been a story that's kind of, they've taken the word and they've created the story around it. I wonder if it just started as a descriptive word to say, this kid was made sick by his environment, and I'm going to call it this sort of clever term, and then it became a thing.
But I even say that, like, I would challenge was made sick.
Right.
Like, I just, at some point there needs to be responsibility, accountability for living in a society and knowing what you should and shouldn't.
Oh, I agree with you. And I agree it was totally a legal maneuver, a mm-hmm. defense move. But I'm just wondering if mm-hmm. this, you know, now we're having this conversation about is affluenza a real thing? I wonder if even the guy who said it thinks it's a real thing in terms of a diagnostic entity. I doubt it. Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess I'm kind of saw it the same way you did, Dave, that he was, you know, he came up with this kind of catchy phrase and decided to throw it out there because it would catch on a little bit and people would pay attention. But, you know, whether he meant it diagnostically or not doesn't really matter, because the way that everyone's kind of reacted to it, and I don't think he was irresponsible, you know, even for putting it out there necessarily. But, you know, the way people are latching onto it, I mean, it's got, obviously it's got some, you know, it's resonating with people that this, you know, maybe not even necessarily as an excuse, but as a descriptive term of our society.
Yeah. And I also would say I can imagine a lot of psychologists who would latch on to that, who would say, oh, affluenza, that's a real thing. It's not the child's responsibility and blah, 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 blah. Like, I can see that as well.
Yeah, that to me, that's the more interesting component about this is the psychologist's role. And unfortunately, I tend to agree with Frank there that I could easily see people in terms of trying to help others and enhance their lives redirect responsibility and accountability for the actions in their life.
Well, I think all of us here tend to focus on personal responsibility when we're talking with people and emphasize that. I don't know if we did a survey of psychologists, how many of them don't do that versus do in terms of their bias or emphasis. But I'll tell you, the kid's 100% responsible for what he did. I mean, there's not going to be any disagreement around the table about that. But what is interesting is in this sort of second part of this story, his mother really did go on the run with him, pay his strip club bill, do all the, like,
which makes her the most awesome mom of all time, right?
You know, I mean, you know, enabled him in this way. And that was the guy's point, I think.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, apart from it being a legal defense, the guy's point is, This kid is in a family system that's sick, that, like,
they all need to go to jail.
And the mom has proven
all
it
right, yeah.
in a very public way.
Throw them all in jail to protect us.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that makes me think, too, about how many people we, you know, and I agree, like, I believe in individual responsibility and accountability. But, you know, thinking within the legal system, too, when we look at, you know, the number of minorities who are in, you know, the prison system and the legal system or whatever, and whether, you know, when they're on a case-by-case basis kind of held accountable for their individual actions and not necessarily the environments that they grew up in or you know, mm-hmm. their place in society, and that isn't really raised in their defense very often. They're, you know, which when I think it should. So that's
right.
kind of the counter to that.
Absolutely. Good stuff. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, it'll be our trending topic. This is the Shrink Tank Podcast. We'll be right back. Available now from Hero House Books, Mixed Shrinks, Ridiculous Real Life Stories from Shrinks. Have you ever wanted to read funny stories from a bunch of shrinks? Well, neither have we, but somehow it made it into a book. And it's a great book, too. Shrinks share some of their funniest true life stories, and we've got some doozies. It's Mixed Shrinks, available now at HeroHousePublishing.com or Amazon. Welcome back to the Shrink Tank Podcast. Dave Verhagen along with Frank the Psych Weasel, Jonathan Hederle, and Rachel Kitson. And our trending topic today is award bait movies. We are in the middle, smack dab in the middle of award season. We've already had the Golden Globes. We have had the Oscar nominations, and it's all kinds of good stuff. We're going to talk about movies that are not only made for award bait or that are function as award bait and really draw that kind of love, but we want to talk about the whole process itself of why we love these kind of prestige movies. And of course, there have been the usual snubs and surprises, but there have been a number of films that are getting some, not only nominations, but some love. I'm going to just read a number of movies, some of which have gotten good love in, some have gotten left out, and just ask you guys what films that of this bunch and maybe some others that you'd add that you particularly enjoyed, some that you missed and haven't picked up yet, and maybe some that you didn't like that other people liked. So, of course, we have Star Wars, then there's Mad Max, The Big Short, Concussion, Spotlight, Creed, The Martian, Sicario, Brooklyn, The Revenant, Hateful Eight, Inside Out, Ex Machina, Room, Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, Steve Jobs. That's just a few. There are others. anybody want to jump in about movies that you this year have particularly loved among that list, or even ones that weren't mentioned?
I love The Martian, and I also love Ex Machina. Ex Machina just blew my mind, and I bought it. I've seen it 3 or 4 times now, and it makes you really think about the future and the reality that we currently live in.
Jonathan gave that to me for Christmas you did. You gave it to me. That's right. And I have yet to see it. It is sitting literally right there, the next in line to see, and I've not
it's
seen
still
it.
Still my favorite movie of the year.
Really?
And the special
of all the stuff you've seen.
Yeah.
The special effects for Ex Machina, if Star Wars and Ex Machina are for an award, Ex Machina will win. Well, it'll beat it.
Yeah, and it's interesting. When I was making my list of my favorite movies of the year, I was surprised by how many movies came out earlier in the year, because these were films that either they didn't get made to be Oscar bait and an award prestige. It was because they had a great story, great director, great casting, and it all just kind of worked together. And there are some directors that I tend to really enjoy their craft, like David Fincher. So even though he'll oftentimes make award bait type of films, like, his movies don't always come out like in 3 theaters in December to qualify for awards. They'll come out in October. They'll come out at any part of the year, because he makes good movies, and his reputation oftentimes will open up opportunity for prestige. Same thing with Quentin Tarantino and maybe Wes Anderson as well. But like, David Russell is a director that I automatically think of as award bait. I just feel like he has this template. He says, if I check this off, I check this off, I check that off, we're going to get nominations. And you see that it's worked for his actors, but he usually gets a lot of nominations and very few wins. And I feel like his trope is kind of starting to wear thin on him.
What would be the examples of films that he does?
He did
Silver Linings Playbook.
Silver Linings Playbook.
Joy.
Joy, which is really right now the one that they're saying, okay, he needs to reconfigure his formula. And then American Hustle as well. The Fighter he did as well.
Mm-hmm. And there are a couple of those movies that I liked, but none that I loved.
Yeah.
For me. I mean, I've had a lot of people say how much they loved, for example, Silver Linings Playbook, especially people that have had people with mental illness in their family. But I liked the movie. I thought it was good. I did not love it. It's not going to show up on a top 50 of mine.
And it's really funny. Before he all of a sudden stepped into that sort of prestige role, my favorite movies of David Russell were the earlier ones, like Three Kings or Flirting with Disaster, where it wasn't award bait. He was just had this quirky story, great casting, and it was a great movie.
I like Three Kings way better.
Yeah. Me too.
Rachel, any movies that are standing out for you this year, or have you not gotten out very much?
I haven't gotten out very much. There's some. I am very interested in seeing Brooklyn. I'm curious about that one. And some of the other movies that sounded good to me, at least, are The Room. I'd like to see that. And Ex Machina, obviously, that's come up a number of times on this show. It's something I definitely want to check out.
The movies that, as of now, as we're talking, that I've gotten a chance to see that I really enjoyed this year were Spotlight, which was clearly Oscar bait movie, but I thought it was a very strong movie. The Big Short, which was a good ensemble. I love The Martian. I love Star Wars. And I really enjoyed Mad Max. Frank is going to get all wound up about that again, but I really did.
Mad Maxine, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it should have been called, Mad Maxine.
There you go.
Versus Mad Frank.
And so by really almost, well, before this launches, we're going to have seen The Revenant and a few other things. So I haven't had a chance to see that, just out of just circumstance, haven't been able to see it. So that might jump onto my list. Ex Machina might as well. There are a couple movies that other people, critics, tended to love and have gotten a little bit of buzz with nominations and so on that I did not love. And I'll just give you two. One is Steve Jobs. I thought the performance was terrific. And I love, why am I blanking on the...
Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah, I love Aaron Sorkin. I mean, I think he's a tremendous writer. The Social Network was my favorite movie of that year. I did not love Steve Jobs. It felt very stagey and contrived, and I didn't buy it. And then another movie that got a lot of attention and was talked about early on as a early Oscar contender was Sicario. And I thought it was okay, but nothing great. I mean, it'd be a movie that if you asked me, I'd say, yeah, sure, see it. But beyond that, it's not nearly as great as I had heard.
For me, the movie of the year that was the biggest letdown for me was Inside Out. I went in expecting Beyond Nemo or something just amazing, and it doesn't crack my top 8 of the Pixar films. I just walked out going, okay, whatever.
Yeah, that's interesting because a lot of people, I'm not one of these, but a lot of people said that's their Pixar's deepest film, their best film. I wouldn't put it up there in the top 5, really.
Did you see what circulated on social media? Somebody edited it to where they took all the inside scenes out, and so now it's just about this girl that has to move, and now she's really sad.
and playing hockey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. I think maybe that is an example of a group of people remembering something that didn't happen. That they're remembering what a great film Inside Out was, but it really didn't happen.
Maybe.
To me right now, the thing that could shake up my top 10 list is The Revenant. Because Alejandro Gonzalez, Iñárritu, like Birdman. I mean, the guy is pedigree, and the story behind this movie and how it was made just... It feeds a part of my brain that I love those types of movies, those real intense type of films. But when I look back at my list, I'm surprised by it. It was either smaller scale independent films like Ex Machina, Room made my list. There's this great movie called When We're Young with Ben Stiller, Naomi Watts, and Adam Driver.
I
thought that was
Driver.
So bad. I love
that.
I
bad.
I can contribute, but yeah.
But then it's also filled with these movies that are big scale, but they weren't necessarily made for Oscar or award bait. Like The Martian really is more of a late summer type of quality made film.
Telling a great story.
It just hits all the cylinders. And it didn't make my top 10, but Star Wars, you know, easily made my top 15. And that is not a movie that anybody had any aspirations that it was going to be getting any type of major awards like Best Picture or Actress, but it is a great film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think most of us would agree on that. I mean, it's getting a little bit of backlash, but it is. How about for you guys, any performances that really jumped out this year? Like anything that really stood out?
What's the guy in Martian? What's his name?
Matt Damon.
I have Swiss cheese brain. I cannot remember actors' names.
That's worse than me not remembering Aaron Sorkin. Way worse.
You can't remember where you park your car. I don't want to hear about that. So, what was his name? Matt Damon? All right.
What was his name, Matt Damon?
His portrayal of the character from the book was perfect. It was, because I read the book first, and I just thought, somebody's got to really pull off the humor side of it and the science side of it. And he nailed it. He absolutely nailed the book. And I so rarely, like the opposite of that was the Moby Dick movie. What was the name of it?
Into the Heart of the Sea.
The Heart of the Sea. Horrible.
And that was Oscar bait. And it died.
That was Oscar bait.
That died after the critic screening.
I saw that before it came out, and I thought, this is a dud. But I thought The Martian that acting was great.
We're waiting to see The Revenant, but you know, by all accounts, that's going to be the year that Leonardo finally gets the Oscar, and it sounds like it's deserved. But what struck me this year was, unlike in years past, where there were a couple of performances that were just bowl you over. Mm-hmm. There were some solid performances this year. Like Will Smith was good in Concussion, and Michael B. Jordan was good in Creed, but nothing that was like holy mackerel, like what apparently Leonardo is like. But what was really good this year were there a couple of movies where the ensemble was good. Like it was a collective of performances. Mm-hmm. Like Spotlight was just, it's interesting to try to single out one of those performances or two of those performances. It really was an ensemble work. And the same thing for The Big Short. That was one of those films that just, it works because the ensemble works. So I really like the ensemble work on that.
The best performance I saw this year was actually by a child actor in Room. And the name of the child is Jacob Tremblay. And that's hands down the best performance I saw this year.
Yeah, that's the reason I want to see that film. I have not seen it, but everybody that has seen it has said the same thing. I mean, yeah. that's fantastic. So before we wrap this up, why do you think that we care about this kind of thing? Psychologically, what's the appeal of these sort of prestige movies and us talking about them and other people? You know, it generates, at least among some sectors, it generates a lot of interest and a lot of conversation.
I think it's the same. We do it every day all around. It's the same thing with sports and Super Bowl and NCAAs and who can beat who and competition, categorizing things. I mean, I think it falls into that sort of category of sorting and organizing information.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's always, we like to rank things and we like to compare notes. And I think there's also, you know, from a critic standpoint, this idea of being a connoisseur of like knowing good art and knowing good acting, and people like to throw their hat in because it kind of gives them some cachet as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think validation. I mean, that's the highest esteem. That's the Pulitzer, that's the Nobel for films. And that's also the one that's most recognizable from the general masses as well.
Yeah, I'm one of these people that doesn't think that the awards, particularly the Oscars, are a waste of time. I know a lot of people do, but I'll tell you why I don't, is because I think anytime you encourage people to make better art, it's good for society. Like, I think whatever that looks like, if it's an award that people strive for and they make art better, whether it's in film or in music or whatever the dominant art forms are in culture, to me, that feels like just plus. Feels like a good thing. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, it's going to be our doctor's orders. This is the Shrink Tank Podcast. Available now from Hero House Books, Cinemanalysis by Craig Pullman and Josh Jensen. Cinemanalysis connects films to psychology through double features. These are movies paired because they share striking amounts of cinematic DNA, as if they were separated at birth. Each chapter describes a double feature, including why the movies can be appreciated more by viewing them together. Then psychological ideas are illustrated through the paired films. Pick up Cinemanalysis at HeroHousePublishing.com or Amazon.com. And we wrap this all up with our doctor's orders. I'm here with Frank the Psych Weasel, Jonathan Hederle, and Rachel Kitson. And we're going to talk about things that we're personally enjoying in pop culture. And Frank, what do you have for us?
I have got a video game that I have become stuck on with my new Xbox One, which I got over the holidays, and it's Ori and the Forest. And it is visually stunning. It's absolutely stunning. And it's sort of like Metroid. It's single player and there are levels. The cool thing about it is you get to save pretty much wherever you want, which is nice and new to, it's new and old to gaming. But the game made a profit within the first few weeks, and it's massively programmed from people all around the world, and Microsoft's who publishing, but it's this story of this little creature, and there's this Japanese, I think it's Japanese dialogue, and the music is amazing. It's good for all ages. It's endearing, but visually it's stunning.
Say the title one more time.
Ori and the Forest, and it's only $19.
What a bargain.
There's a small little movie that's now available for rent or video on demand. I found it on Amazon Prime for free. It's called I'll See You in My Dreams. It's just a really small film starring Blythe Danner, Gene Squibb, Rhea Perlman, and Sam Elliott. And I think it's a really tender look at finding love at sort of that last chapter of life and when your friends are aging and dying and your widows, like kind of how you can sort of rekindle love and relationships at that later stage. It's a really good movie.
I'm depressed now, but thank you.
Now you're depressed. That's what did it. For me, I'm going to recommend something that has already aired its season, but you can, if you have cable where you have on demand, I really want to encourage you to do this. And that is to watch The Returned, the French version of this.
Oh,
the season
yeah.
wrapped up back in December, but I finished it up during the holiday break, and I so loved the ending of the second season. I got obsessive with it. I was reading everything, and I was kind of like frustrated when people were like, that ending made no sense. I was like, it made perfect sense. I'm not that every detail made sense. That's part of the point of the show, is that there's still going to be mystery hanging out there, but the main point of the show really tied together. And You have to be able to read. That's one requirement, right, because it's all in subtitles. And you have to have some tolerance of spooky French television. But if you would really like a cool show, you saw it, didn't you?
Yeah. I've said this before, but my ringtone is the opening music to that show because it freaks me out.
I thought it was great. I will say you could jump in season two, but you really shouldn't.
Don't. Start from the beginning.
Right. It needs to be both seasons. And whether there's a season three or not, season one and two really stand together. They're really a package deal. So that's The Returned, or Le Revenant.
Le Revenant.
Revenant. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of the Shrink Tank Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Shrink Tank Talk, or you can like us on Facebook, please do, by searching for Shrink Tank. And of course, you can check us all out on the shrinktank.com website, where you're going to find all kinds of articles about all kinds of cool things in popular culture. Our engineer and audio wizard is Zach Brown. For Rachel Kitson, Jonathan Hederle, and Frank Gaskell, I'm Dave Verhagen. Have a great week.